Hello and welcome back, podheads, to another episode of Over My Dead Pod. I am your host for today, Kate Carter.
I'm Kylie Colwell.
And I'm Holly Spear.
I feel like you guys might know the name of this person, but you might not know the backstory.
Can I guess?
I would love for you to guess, Kylie, because I have given no information away.
Jack the Ripper.
No, but wouldn't have that been so good?
I was just thinking about that. It's on my list, but it's too big.
Today's story, I'm going to do a deep dive into what some people call the real life boogeyman. And I'm not going to lie, a few years ago, I watched this investigative documentary called Cropsey, and it kind of blew my mind. If you haven't seen it, Cropsey, Cropsey. But to give you a little background on the documentary, it's from 2009, and it basically starts off with, like, they're searching for what is termed a Cropsey. So Cropsey is like a person, which is what they say is a real life boogeyman from New York City. Cropsey at this point is like an urban legend. It's not a real person. Quickly, these filmmakers, while they're doing the documentary, they hone in to a guy who becomes their version of an actual Cropsey. And so I am now going to bring you that story of this guy, the real life boogeyman, the Cropsey that we are going to talk about, the Andre Rand. Okay, so we're going to talk about the Cropsey legend itself for a bit. I just kind of want you to have the background history lesson before we get into the actual story of Andre Rand today. So back in the 1970s in New York, specifically Staten Island, there was this urban legend talked about by teenagers of like this boogeyman who would kidnap children and brutally murder them and stuff like that, you know, just spook you up at campfires and shit like that. And so the story goes that there was this man named George Cropsey, and he was like this well-known local man. He was a judge, and him and his wife and his son had this lake cottage in Wurtsboro, New York, which happened to be by, it was like on the same property as like a summer camp. And one day there was like a group of campers that snuck out of their cabins at night. They went to go make a bonfire in the woods. At some point that bonfire got out of hand and basically burned down the woods, and it burned down Cropsey's cottage house. Well, his wife and his son were in the house. Apparently George Cropsey was arriving to the cottage when he saw it in flames. His wife made it out, but George and her could hear the screams of their dying son inside. So George tries to go into the house, save his son, doesn't make it. George gets burned. The kid dies. Basically, within a week of that fire happening, remember, this is all just an urban legend, George's wife then commits suicide. So like he just lost his house with his son inside in a fire lit by campers. And then his wife has now committed suicide, I assume, because she was so distraught. So basically, George's life is a shit show.
If this were a true story, I would also haunt the entire town if I were George.
1000%, especially the campers, right?
Yes.
Yes. So that's when the rumors began. So after the death of his family members, George Cropsey wasn't seen for months. And during this time, it was quote unquote said that he was seeking revenge on the kids at the local summer camp where the cottage that he owned was at. Some people say that George had been admitted to a psych hospital after the death of his family, but like he escaped and he was now driven to kidnap and murder campers who are all like youngins. His first victim, he abducted from one of the cabins. He dragged around the cabin to the woods and chopped him up with an axe. And then the second victim, he was about to kill the second victim when a camp counselor saw him, and a camp counselor turned his flashlight on George. And that's the first time that anybody had ever seen George Cropsey as this boogeyman like figure before. And he's like burned and got blood all over him and all this stuff. And once George got the flashlight shown on him by the camp counselor, he like starts to run, drops the kid, runs off into the forest. Well, he's bleeding. And so there's like this trail of blood that goes into the forest. And so the cops try to come and search for him. I mean, it's a whole freaking story, but they're never able to find George Cropsey in the woods. Like he's never seen again after his family died. That's basically like the legend is now every year on the son's death anniversary, Cropsey comes out at this lake where the summer camp is and he tries to murder children. So as you can see from this Cropsey legend, what it sounds like to me is this was a story that a camp counselor made up to tell campers at fire pit while they're like making s'mores during summer camp.
A good way to make sure your little campers don't go running out into the woods.
Yep. Yeah. So that's like, you know, it's just this fun story. Well, fun to us people who love murder. Obviously, back then, kids are like believing this story. They start to get freaked out. It becomes more popular, blah, blah, blah. Since then, there have been movies made off of this urban legend of Cropsey. From 1981, there was The Burning. Friday the 13th is kind of played off of Cropsey. And then Sleepaway Camp, that was from the 80s. And actually, the movie Sleepaway Camp, it shows this different version of Cropsey, where these campers are being murdered by this deranged killer from a mental institute out in Staten Island. And apparently one of the mental institute patients escaped. He was living under the tunnels in the institute, and he would come out at night and kidnap children and butcher them. So like when this movie came out in the 80s, unfortunately, it was actually pretty poor timing because the movie was based around Staten Island. Well, wouldn't you know, in Staten Island, kids were disappearing at that exact same time as well. Was it related? I don't know. But it was poor timing on the filmmakers to make a movie of something that was happening in the moment. And it kind of hit home for like the Staten Island locals. And they began to think like, hey, what if this Cropsey urban legend isn't just a legend? And so that's where we get to our story today. And that is of the real life boogeyman, the real life Cropsey, Mr. Andre Rand. Story takes place in Staten Island, New York. A little background about Staten Island, just really quickly. It's one of five boroughs of New York City, about 500,000 residents living there. And I didn't know this, but back in like the 1900s, people moved to Staten Island so they could get away from like the crowds, and they could buy land in Staten Island and like not be up against their neighbors 24/7. At some point, unfortunately, Staten Island got the label as like being a dumping ground for New York City's garbage. To this day, it's still one of the largest dumping grounds of New York City. And not to mention, it didn't only become a dumping ground for trash, but also kind of for like displaced people, whether they were alive or dead. And a lot of the displaced people in Staten Island were mental patients, which is very interesting. With that also came murder victims. So basically, Staten Island became this place that was just like, you need to get rid of someone or something, you go to Staten Island. But in the middle of Staten Island, there's this area of forest that is called the Greenbelt. And within the Greenbelt, there's like a few summer camps there. And there's also a few abandoned institutions. The one in today's story is an institution that no longer exists, but it's called Willowbrook State School. And it was an institution for children with mental disabilities. Opened its doors in 1947 and closed exactly 40 years later. It was the home to the largest population of youth with intellectual disabilities in the world, which is nuts. Like, they just shoved kids with mental problems in there. If you had a mentally challenged kid of any age, birth to whatever, and you didn't want them anymore, you just dropped them off at Willowbrook and they would be in there until they died. It was just like, they're like naked, sitting on the ground, fending for themselves, poop everywhere. Like, there was, I mean, sure, there was people that worked there and whatnot, but from what I read, some of the people that worked there also had mental issues. So it was just, it literally was disgusting.
It looks like the mental institution from Shutter Island.
1,000%. In 1972, a documentary came out by this journalist. He was a local Staten Island guy named Geraldo Rivera. And this documentary basically exposed Willowbrook for like how fucking awful it was. And it was the first time the outside world had ever seen what Willowbrook looked like inside. Like, parents dropping off their kids there to live the rest of their lives and never see them again did not know what existed on the inside. So like, this dude exposed Willowbrook. In the documentary, you can see these kids just laying on the floor, usually naked, rolling around in poop, vomit everywhere. Like, they were dying pretty quickly. It was basically just like a free-for-all there. 99% of them could not fend for themselves because of how severe their intellectual disabilities were. So like, it just pisses me off. But not only did it expose like the conditions of Willowbrook, but it also, there was so many allegations of like sexual abuse, physical abuse, medical abuse from this place. Apparently, if your kid was dropped off over the age of one, it was assumed the parents were not coming back for the kid. So the people who worked at Willowbrook would then take it upon themselves to conduct medical tests on these children as like test subjects for the country. Like researchers would come in and inject these kids with certain things, in particular hepatitis, and then would study how these kids would turn out. So it basically became known as a mental institute that also was a hepatitis research center. So that's fucking awful. Nothing was done about it for 40 years. In the 70s, there weren't really any laws in place yet to protect people with disabilities, especially those that had like been institutionalized. And after about 10 years of people just bitching, trying to sue this place, especially the locals, Willowbrook finally got shut down in 1987. And when it was shut down, all of the kids that were still there were like shipped off to different institutions around the world. But some of the kids were just left there, forgot that there was some kids there.
I don't think they forgot. I think they just didn't care.
I think they didn't care. When the place got shut down, kids were shipped off. Some people were still left there. Those people lived in Willowbrook and in the tunnels. And that was the way to like get around the property, because this property was like 300 plus acres, like freaking huge. It wasn't just like a standalone place either. There were multiple buildings. It wasn't just like one place. So there was this tunnel system. Originally, employee used it to like get around from one property to another, but some of the kids went to the tunnels. Some of the kids became homeless within Staten Island. And at some point, because some of the staff lost their jobs, obviously, with Willowbrook closing, some of the staff members also had mental issues themselves. They joined the other mental handicapped kids, and Willowbrook land basically became this like camping ground for the mentally challenged, which is very sad and terrifying at most. At the exact same time that Willowbrook got closed down, in Staten Island, there were 7 cases of children who had gone missing. So when the mental institute closed down and all these rumors started and that movie came out about Cropsey, it basically just brought this Cropsey legend to life. And so our first case of the day, in 1987, around the same time as Willowbrook closing, July 9th, to be exact, there was a 12-year-old named Jennifer Lynn. Jennifer Lynn had Down syndrome. She was not at Willowbrook. She lived out with her parents. Like, she was never there. Jennifer went to a public school on that July 9th day. She went outside to go for a walk after like a daycare program, which was something very normal for her to do. Like, it was safe for them to walk around. Nobody had issues with that. And she never came home. Immediately, her parents reported her missing. The neighborhood community really rallied together with hopes that they could find Jennifer. But with Jennifer's family home being somewhat close to the Willowbrook campus, police and community members did end up going there to search. And that also led to police going into the tunnels, which is when we really found out about like people had been left at Willowbrook and stuff, like, and the homeless and whatnot. But unfortunately, no one saw Jennifer again. A few days later, after she went missing, 2 witnesses came forward and they told investigators that they saw Jennifer on that July day that she went missing, and she was walking down a street with a man. And this man, apparently next to Jennifer, was pushing a green bicycle. And so keep that in your head, because that's going to pop up a lot in this story. Shortly after those witnesses came forward, one of the New York police detectives was at this local grocery store in Staten Island. He was sitting in the parking lot and he saw a guy with a green bicycle, and it was a perfect match to what those people, the witnesses, had said. And he looked up at this man and he was like, wait a minute, you're familiar. It was 43-year-old Andre Rand. So Andre is a convicted criminal. Detective had recognized him from previous cases. And the detective obviously stops Andre right away, brings him in for questioning. When the detective is like, what are you doing? Like, why are you at the grocery store kind of stuff? Andre was like, I'm buying baby food. Andre didn't have a kid. So a little weird to say that. He also did have baby food with him. Don't understand any of that. But they let him go because there was no evidence that like he had kidnapped Jennifer or anything. After Andre left, the detectives continue to like dig into his background, because right now that's their only lead, is like this dude Andre, who is a convicted criminal. He rides around Staten Island on a green bicycle. People said they saw Jennifer with a man in a green bicycle. And so how many green bicycles are there out there? I don't know. I don't even know that I've ever seen a green bicycle. But what was found out is that Andre had previously worked as a custodian at the Willowbrook Institute. He was also living in the various buildings and tunnels on the Willowbrook property as part of the homeless community. That information mixed with a criminal record kind of let the investigators pursue Andre as their number one suspect in Jennifer's disappearance. You ask me, who is Andre Rand? Well, his real name was Frank Ruchon. And I say that because he changed his name a few times, which is a little suspicious, but we'll get into it. He was born in 1944 to his mom and his dad, and the youngest of two siblings. Now, his mom was known to have mental and physical handicaps. Like, she was mentally challenged and she also couldn't walk that well. Well, she had Andre. Andre also had mental and physical handicaps. And so I want you to keep that in mind for the rest of the story, that while I'm talking about Andre, he lived on his own. He was able to have his own jobs. Like, he did his own thing. He did have disabilities. On his 14th birthday, his dad passed away. His mom got institutionalized at a psych center. He basically, him and his siblings had to fend for themselves. I don't know if his siblings had issues. I wasn't able to find anything about that. But after high school, Andre attempted to go into the U.S. Army, but wasn't allowed in. And so he kind of was just stuck in his home area of Staten Island and was like, I need to find a job to be able to live somewhere and whatnot. So he found work at the brand new, at the time, Willowbrook Institution. At Willowbrook, he was known under his real name of Frank, but he had changed his last name to Bruchette. So we don't know why, but it just kind of seems like he's going to change his name a few times. At that time that he got hired at Willowbrook, Andre was homeless. And so he pretty much just made camp at the Willowbrook property in one of the forested areas nearby, but he also just happened to occasionally live in the institute. He pretty much started having run-ins with the law as soon as he started working at Willowbrook. Within a year of his employment there, he was arrested for kidnapping and raping a 9-year-old girl. Yep, comes at you pretty quickly.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting that early. I'm just going to assume he was still allowed to work there after this.
Yep. So apparently Andre had like lured this 9-year-old. Now, this is in the 60s. He had lured this 9-year-old girl into a car. He drove her to like a parking lot and was taking her clothes off when somehow a cop pulled up next to them, saw all this happening, and was able to stop Andre before anything happened. So Andre was arrested. And though he denied the allegations, he was found guilty of sexual abuse and sentenced to only 4 years in prison. Now, I say only 4 years because that's, you fucking believe that was my child. You ain't getting 4 years for that kind of thing. But we also don't know if it happened because there's going to be a lot of allegations in this case. Because of this, he went to prison. It was supposed to be 4 years. He had good behavior and was released after 14 months. So pretty quick stint. After he was released, he changed his name to Andre Rand. Now, that's the name for the rest of the story. It kind of seems, from what I could put together, is when big events happened in his life and they didn't go well, he would change his name. Maybe it was him like erasing the other parts of his life. Like, he was like, new name, they're not going to figure out my history kind of thing.
Yeah, I'd imagine if you get caught doing that to a 9-year-old and then you're released back out into the public, you'd probably want to change your name.
Yeah, not a good thing. Now I don't think they let you. Okay, so after his little jail stint, he continued on committing other crimes. So in 1979, he was accused of raping two 15-year-old girls, but apparently neither of them ended up pressing formal charges. So nothing came of that. And then this is a weird one. In 1983, Andre was driving a school bus and he picked up a random group of elementary school kids. He drove them from their YMCA to go get food together, and then he drove them to the Newark International Airport. When he arrived at the airport, he was arrested, and he was charged with unlawful imprisonment. But once again, for some reason, he only received 10 months in jail. So that whole story is weird. Like, he just picks up random kids. He's like, let's go get food together. And then he was driving them to an airport. So I don't know what the intentions were there.
I mean, we don't know how mentally disabled.
Yeah.
But that's
we know that he's mentally challenged
in some capacity. So
yes, just keep that in mind.
Yeah.
Okay. And then a few years later is when that 12-year-old Jennifer went missing. So while the police are investigating Andre because of the whole like green bicycle thing, that was his way of getting around where he lived in Staten Island. He had a green bicycle. Local community members continued their search for Jennifer. At one point, there was this local guy. His name was George Kramer. He was on the Willowbrook Institution property, like looking around. Him and his wife, remember, they were going for a walk one day and they saw this like mound of fresh dirt and they didn't think anything of it. They thought like somebody was gardening on the property. And he went back a few days later because he felt something was off. And so, of course, as he began digging into the ground, he was shortly met with the smell of flesh.
Even more anxiety for the family of Jennifer Schweiger. The body of a young child was found buried in a fresh grave on Staten Island last night. It was a young girl. The question now, is it their daughter or another family's daughter who has been suffering the same tragedy? We have team coverage on the search now, beginning with John Slattery, who's live on Staten Island. John?
Carol, the body found last night has not yet been positively identified. The medical examiner's office has said merely it is the body of a young girl. And the police are helping the medical examiner in his investigation.
We've provided Dr. Gross with dental charts and fingerprints to try to determine the identity of the person. After that, then Dr. Gross is going to be conducting tests as to what the cause of death was.
Police say they could know later today or tomorrow if the body is that of Jennifer Schweiger. One of the volunteers who helped in the search is a friend of Jennifer's parents.
They're very, very upset. We did not have any confirmation on the body yet, and we were just sitting and waiting.
Among those volunteers who actually found the body were George Kramer, a retired fireman, and his wife, Nancy, who'd searched the area before and decided to go back to a mound they had seen.
There was like a soft mound of dirt there, and I just kind of felt sick to my stomach. I felt like she was there, and I told my husband, I said, Jennifer, she's there. And then we started digging with sticks, and it was soft dirt.
Now, the body was found in that shallow grave about 8 o'clock last night. Channel 2's Mary Murphy was at the site all night long. Here is her report.
It was a place they had checked before, turning up nothing. But when a retired fireman returned just before 8 p.m. last night, he dug into the mound of dirt he had noticed last Saturday near Building 27 and discovered flesh, then a hand and foot. Medical examiner Elliot Gross made the finding official at 2 a.m.
They have a body of short stature that was covered with dirt and is going to have to be examined tomorrow.
As soon as the body was removed by ambulance at 3 a.m., the testing began to determine if this was indeed Jennifer Schweiger, the 12-year-old girl with Down syndrome who disappeared 5 weeks ago, last seen walking hand in hand with a local drifter. Last week, police arrested 43-year-old Andre Rand, a convicted child sex offender, and charged him with kidnapping Jennifer. Now they want to know if Rand is connected to the disappearance of other Staten Island girls and whether any more bodies are buried on the old Willowbrook grounds.
There may be other bodies there. We don't know.
Do you have any reason?
And there may be other evidence connected with this body.
Police say they found the body about 100 feet from Andre Ron's old campsite. Residents report he had lived here on and off for many years. And one man told us that several weeks after Jennifer Schweiger was reported missing, he heard a child scream near Building 27 here on the Willowbrook grounds.
So at that point, when her body was found, she had been missing for 35 days. So like I just said, her body had been buried in a very shallow grave on the Willowbrook property. And it was actually only about like 100 feet away from one of the buildings, which was building number 27, which was also where Andre would sleep at night with some of his friends. When Jennifer's body was found, she was fully naked. Her clothes were never found. So what happened to Jennifer? Well, detectives on the case examined her body and they were able to tell that there was blood pooling in her feet. So basically, for those who don't know, blood pooling is, especially in the feet, is due to circulation being cut off somewhere else on the body. And it basically means that she was killed in an upright position. She like wasn't laying down in the grave or on the ground when she died. She was standing up, which led to all the blood like rushing down to her feet. But get this, this is weird. Her cause of death, it was listed as asphyxia, but because of the bad decomposition of her body, the medical examiner couldn't tell what caused the asphyxiation. So she had no bruising on her body, no lacerations, no broken bones, but they were able to tell that she had basically choked to death. The manner of her death was put down as asphyxia, but her cause of death wasn't really known. With all of that being said, Andre had been arrested in connection with Jennifer's disappearance about a week before her body was actually found. And when he was arrested, he was tasked with going on like a 30-day psych hold and evaluation, because obviously when they brought Andre in, they could tell that he had issues. They wanted to see what a psychiatrist would say is going on. But once Jennifer's body had been found, Andre's charge of kidnapping at the time was quickly changed to first-degree murder. How or why did the police arrest Andre? They didn't have any proof. They just kind of were connecting dots from different things. Jennifer went missing. A few days later, the police got tips about the man with the green bike. The cops saw Andre, like said that he saw Andre with a green bike. It was known that Andre owned a green bike and that's how he transported himself around Staten Island. So they brought him in for questioning. Couldn't figure out any ties, released him. But they never really gave up on the idea that maybe Andre had something to do with it. I think the green bike thing just threw it for them. So they put up a 24/7 surveillance on Andre. At that time, Andre was bouncing back and forth between sleeping at one of the buildings, number 27, at Willowbrook, and also crashing at the house of a local priest. Don't know how that came into play, but he was doing it. And according to the priest, this is where the police got their information. The priest said that Andre told him that he had kidnapped Jennifer. Andre told the priest that when he found Jennifer walking alone that day, he thought like, oh, her family doesn't want her, just like the rest of the kids at Willowbrook. And so he took her. He also mentioned that people with mental disabilities shouldn't exist. And so, and this is the priest saying that to the cops. And so obviously that statement is what made the investigators believe that Jennifer might not be alive at this point, because it was a week before her body was found. All of that being said, though, this was just word of mouth coming from the priest to the police. There was no physical evidence or audio evidence of like Andre ever saying this or having anything to do with Jennifer. So obviously when it came to Andre's name being released to the public pretty much immediately with Jennifer's death, the like locals had kind of mixed reactions to it, which I understand. And I also do want to say, like, when the priest said that Andre said people with disabilities shouldn't exist, Andre was quite aware that he had disabilities. So like, to me, that kind of throws me for a loop.
Yeah. And he was also living with people who have disabilities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I find that a little weird. Locals kind of went back and forth on like what they thought about Andre. Some people thought that Andre had been targeted because of who he was, like where he lived, his lifestyle, his background, his disabilities. But then others basically went like full force into the fact of like, Andre did it. You know, he's the boogeyman. He's this mentally handicapped dude who is the Cropsy that we've all been like watching in the news. And these rumors spread so quickly about Andre, whether or not people knew they were true. And some of the things that like were circling in the media as soon as Jennifer's body was found and Andre's name was released is like the media was saying like Andre would dig up bodies of kids, have sex with them, and then sell the bodies to cults.
Yeah, I don't know about that one.
Like, where'd that even come, you know, like where'd that come from? Now, don't get me wrong, like we're full like satanic panic mode right now too in this day and age. These rumors definitely fueled the police investigation against Andre. And even though there was zero physical evidence, no personal items, no DNA, no fingerprints, nothing, the New York Police Department publicly stated that Andre was their guy. They even started to put blame on him for other children's disappearances in the area. He was blamed for a few other kids, and I'm going to get to those kids because I want you to have the full experience with this. But they also really ran with the fact of what the media said about the whole satanic thing. And so they were like, oh, he worships the devil too. So like, he's kidnapping these kids, whether they're alive or not. He's having sex with their bodies. He's doing culty stuff. He's worshiping the devil. Like, it's just this whole ludicrous idea came out of nowhere. You know, there was no proof of any of that. Like I said, the satanic panic was going on at the exact same time. So people were freaked out in general. But the real reason that the police believed this, other than what was going on in the media, is because once Jennifer's body was found, her family started getting letters in the mail, like physical letters, telling them that Andre had been supplying dead children to a cult. And these letters mentioned a specific cult. It was the Process Church of the Final Judgment, which I actually hadn't heard of before, and I like my cults. But apparently it was like this religious group that had been formed by two former Scientology members. They had been kicked out of Scientology and they formed this group themselves in the 60s. And it started off as like a quote unquote semi-normal church, because we don't know about the Scientology peoples. But at some point it kind of turned, because by the 70s, they were totally worshiping Satan. It was a satanic church, like 100%. And that's what they ended up being known for. But they also, this cult church was actually a part of, like, they were potentially known to being involved in the Manson murders. Like, so if you guys remember when I talked about the Manson murders on one of our episodes, which you should go listen to because that was a really good story, not to hype myself up. But there was lots of mentions of cults, and like that Charles had been in other cults prior to starting his own like family stuff. And apparently this was one of them. And then this cult also had been in the Son of Sam murders, like, area too. So it was like well known at this time of Andre's case. Once the letters came in with this group's name, Jennifer's family obviously shared that with the police. Those notes were also made public. So the conspiracy just kind of grew from there of like, Andre's this horrific person. You know, he's part of all of these things, but yet still no physical evidence. So we get to his trial, you know, because he's now on first degree murder charges. It was in 1988. He was up for kidnapping and murdering Jennifer. But like I said, no evidence. So the prosecution basically was only able to use eyewitness testimonies to try to convict Andre, which is super hard to do. Today, I would say you can't really convict someone off of people's words. Like, you have to have evidence of some sort nowadays, at least.
We believe in science here.
We do. We're big science. We're not Scientologists, but we believe in science. Okay. And so the prosecution in this case, all they had were people's words, and they tried. Don't get me wrong. They called up 10 witnesses, and these witnesses all claimed that they had seen Andre specifically with Jennifer and his freaking green bicycle on the day that Jennifer went missing. Also, remember, only 2 people came forward when this actually happened. So where those other 8 people came from, I don't know. But fortunately, the jury ended up being deadlocked. A mistrial happened, and that was the conclusion of the case. At the end of the same year, in 1988, a new trial happened, and the judge ended up dismissing Andre's murder charge at the time because there was a law in place that a person can be tried for the same charges twice, which still exists to an extent in some places. But in this case, if you were charged in Staten Island or in New York in 1988 with murder, and there was a mistrial, or you were found not guilty, you couldn't be charged with the same murder again.
That's weird.
Yeah. The second trial, obviously his murder charge was dropped, but he was still being charged with kidnapping. Obviously that didn't stop them from trying with the trial. And eventually they were able to convict him, Andre, of Jennifer's kidnapping with no evidence. Andre was sentenced to 25 years to life in prison and had eligibility for parole in 2008. And he was only going to be able to go up for parole if he was not convicted of another crime. And so the public, for the most part, and the police, they all believe the satanic stuff, the murder, the boogeyman, the Cropsey stories. And they're like, we need to keep Andre in prison for as long as possible. How do we do that? Oh, let's connect him to more crimes. Let's get him convicted of more crimes. Investigators at some point ended up chalking up about 35 cases that they thought Andre could be tied to. After going through the investigation process for these cases, going back and forth with the court system, the police were able to actually take on 4 unsolved missing person cases from Staten Island that they truly thought Andre would have something to do with and that they could charge and convict him with. Obviously, like they did with Jennifer's case, they also made this information public immediately. I mean, don't get me wrong, we are in the 80s, and so things are different from then to now, but the whole thing of public knowledge when it comes to cases still to this day blows my fucking mind because of how influenced our court system can be. That, like, you put out information, people believe it. It doesn't matter if it's true. People are going to believe it. If you see on the TV, it's real.
That's what the police knew. And they're like, oh, we want to keep them in prison.
Yeah.
Yeah. If we get everyone on our side, good luck.
Right. Andre's never going to get out, kind of thing, yeah. You know? So they were like, yep, this is our Cropsey. Andre did it. He's a horrific, horrific person. Like, let's figure this out. So I'm going to brief you on these 4 cases that they're trying to charge him with. In 1972, when Andre had been released on parole for that first ever, like, offense with the supposed apparent almost rape of the girl in the car, a 5-year-old, her name was Alice, she went missing from Staten Island. At the time she went missing, she had been living with her mom. She was in the apartment building's lobby with her brother. They were, like, playing in the lobby, doing their own thing. Her brother left her alone for a few minutes while he went to go to use the bathroom. And when he came back, she was gone. This was around 3 p.m. in the afternoon. Her family obviously reported her missing immediately. She's a 5-year-old. A few minutes later, people or someone reportedly saw her playing at a park with someone, but she was never seen again. By 1987, which was like 15 years later, the same year that Jennifer went missing, Alice still hadn't been found. So police made the connection that maybe Andre had something to do with Alice's disappearance because he apparently had been hired as a painter at that apartment complex the same year that Alice went missing. That's it.
The fact that Alice's remains or her have not been found, but Jennifer was not very well hidden and only like 100 feet from where he lived.
Right.
The intelligence levels aren't matching up.
No. But they didn't have anyone to blame for Alice's case, you know? And obviously they're trying to pin shit on Andre. So that was their connection to the case for him. So the second story, this one was in 1981. There was a 7-year-old named Holly Ann Hughes who went missing. Little Holly Ann, 7-year-old, she was in Staten Island. She was visiting a local convenience shop by herself at 9 p.m. That tells you, like, the whole safety differences from then to now. Like, she was just doing her own thing at 9 p.m. 7 years old. It apparently was a convenience shop that was, like, walking distance from her house, and she was buying a bar of soap. Well, she was never seen again. 2 weeks after she went missing, Holly Ann's mom got a phone call from an unknown man who said he had Holly Ann and that the only way he would return her is if the mom met him up for sex. Obviously, Holly Ann's mom, who, by the way, her name was also Holly, called the cops about the phone call, obviously, and they ended up setting up, like, this sting operation to get this guy who was apparently had Holly Ann, but he never showed up. So after she had been missing for months, the Holly Ann's parents actually came forward and said that they were really putting blame on the police department for all of this, saying they had botched the case for Holly Ann. And apparently that's because multiple witnesses had come forward with tips and police never looked into a single one of them, which is crazy. But for Andre's tie in this case, he was actually one of the names that the tips came in about. apparently some witnesses had called and given a tip to the police saying that they had seen a green bicycle at the store when Holly Ann went missing. They didn't specifically name Andre, okay? But they said the freaking green bicycle thing. And so they were like, we saw this green bicycle at the same convenience shop the same night that Holly Ann went missing. That was one of the tips. And the police obviously never looked into any of the tips. So now years later, now that he's in jail, they're trying to bring up old dirt. They look at the freaking tips, and that was one of them. So they were like, Andre did it. Green bicycle.
He's the only person in Staten Island with a green bike.
According to this story. Yes, absolutely. So third case, 3 out of 4. This one is a disappearance of a 10-year-old. Her name is Taze Jackson, and this is from 1983. And something to mention too on this one, Taze is actually mentally and physically challenged as well. Also, the day that she went missing was only 10 days after Andre had been released from jail from doing that whole bus kidnapping thing. So just to mention that. So Taze, her last known location was at a hotel in Staten Island. Her family was living at this hotel after their home had burned down. Regardless of her physical or mental issues, Taze was known really well in the community and would like often go walking about town on her own to run errands. This seems like a very common thing these days. Like nobody had stranger danger kind of stuff in their head. And on August 14th, around 2 p.m., Taze's mother was taking a nap in their hotel room, and Taze went out to go buy lunch at a local supermarket, but never returned. Some witnesses stepped forward saying that they remember seeing Taze at the supermarket at the time that she went missing, and they say that she was with an older gentleman. So as for Andre in this story, apparently at the time he was homeless and he was living in a makeshift shack that happened to be on the same block as the hotel. That's it. Last case of the four they're trying to pin him on. So this one is actually interesting, very short, but it's not a child. And so that's what makes me curious. This one's a 22-year-old. His name is Hank Gaforia. And this is 1984. Now, Hank was mentally challenged, but he was known to be pretty independent. So he lived on his own, worked on his own, did his own thing. So on June 8th of 1984, Hank went out to go drinking. He was by himself. He ended up in a bar in Staten Island. And that is when he was reportedly seen talking to Andre Rand. After Hank left the bar that night, he was never seen again. The only connection that the police have is that somebody said Andre and Hank were together drinking at that bar. That's it.
So we have nothing for all nothing. Five cases.
Yep. Nothing for all five cases being penned, but small things, small little details. But also I feel like if I wanted to pin Kylie on all five of those cases, I could probably figure out a way to pin Kylie. You know, like the way that they're doing Andre's name to all of the cases is they're pulling the smallest, like Staten Island, it's big, but ain't that fucking big. Like all of these people that went missing were in the same radius. It sounds like they were all within like a mile of each other. And so if Andre lives in that mile, it's easy for them to just be like, he was here. Green bicycle, but we don't know.
He is a convicted sexual offender at this point. So it's hard to be like, he's innocent.
Right. That's the, yeah, it's, this whole story just had me go back and forth. So, all right. So those were the four unsolved crimes that the police were now trying to pin on Andre so that he would have to stay in prison longer than the minimum of 25 years for Jennifer's kidnapping. Oh, and just to state this too, at the time, 25 years for kidnapping was actually the maximum sentence that someone could get. So like the judge was really nailing down the hammer on that one. Like he was like, we're going to go for the max. Basically, Andre was being used as an example is what I like to think for the community. Now, while Andre was in prison for the kidnapping charge, apparently, because this whole fucking story is apparently, you know, like my case today is all apparently stuff. Officers and fellow inmates came forward saying that Andre talked about how he had killed Holly Ann and how he was a pedophile. He was saying this out loud. Obviously, that was told to the investigators, the police, and they took that and ran with it. So in 2004, Andre was charged with the kidnapping of Holly Ann Hughes. though there was zero evidence against him. Sound familiar? But it definitely didn't help. This is also just freaking word of mouth, but it didn't help when Holly Ann's mom was brought to the trial and she said, yes, Andre's voice is the voice that I heard on the phone soliciting me for sex in order to get my daughters. Like, she said, Andre's voice is who I heard. Granted, it had been like 20 years or something. I'm like, I'm just saying. It goes without saying, Andre, this entire time, his whole life basically, has maintained his innocence, especially for the kidnapping of Holly Ann Hughes at the time and all of his other charges that were ever brought against him. Andre's attorney even stated that during the trial, Andre told his attorney that he was being transported to the courthouse from the prison and that one of the prison guards told Andre on the bus that he was, quote, a martyr for the safety of children. Like, the prison guard said that to Andre as he's going to trial. And Andre tells his attorney this. So basically, the prison guard is like, we know you didn't do it. We don't have proof that you did it, but we need to pin these deaths on someone. And you fit the role, so we're going to pin it on you, kind of thing. Word of mouth, though, so we don't know. But Holly Ann Hughes' trial took a turn for the worse. And that's because at some point, I think it was like 2 weeks into the trial, one of Holly Ann's former best friends from when she was little, a woman named Tanya, took the stand and said that she had been with Holly Ann when she went missing, which, by the way, was never brought up 20 years ago when this actually took place. But she's now in trial saying she was with Holly Ann when she went missing. And she remembers that a guy in a green bicycle pulled up to them and he had a Halloween mask on. And he asked if they wanted candy and to ride on his bike. And Holly Ann said yes. She went on the bike with him and Tanya never saw her again. Now, a few things. This was never mentioned. Tanya said that Andre was the one that took Holly Ann, but she said he was wearing a Halloween mask. So how would she have known it was Andre? It's the freaking green bike that everyone's just pulling into their cases. But the green bicycle detail is public knowledge. Like, everyone for 20, 30 years now has just pinned the green bicycle with Andre, you know?
Yeah, and like, everyone knows his name and his story by that point.
Right.
So you just make up whatever.
You're going to tell me that Tanya girl was there with Holly Ann when she went missing and, you know, Andre apparently did it, but that was never talked about when the actual disappearance happened? Like, that doesn't make sense to me. I think that's a lie.
Yeah, like, I can understand a child being scared and not saying anything in that moment, but to wait 20 years?
Yeah. Also, it's not random because I talked about it before, but I probably should have mentioned this a little bit more in the story. I did mention at the beginning that Andre was mentally and physically disabled. He was able to read. He was able to write. He worked and lived on his own, obviously, but he did struggle tremendously in his life. Though he had his own issues, Andre was one of those that was actually super intelligent. Anytime he was quoted from his lawyer or anytime he had written something down, like responded to charges, responded to letters from jail, he was extremely well-spoken. He always maintained his innocence on every single charge he ever got. He always said that he was being used as a martyr. And he even, quote, multiple times said that he was part of a local fraud scheme against him. Now, Andre did not make eye contact with people. He did not speak in public. He was often found with his head down. And if you go and look at a picture of him, any of his pictures ever, you will see that Andre Rand is pretty much always photographed with, he was drooling all the time. Like, that's just how he looked. But when he did speak or when he did write, Andre was considered to have a very high IQ. So just something to keep in mind. In October of 2004, at the end of Holly Ann Hughes' trial, Andre was in fact charged and convicted with kidnapping of Holly Ann, and he was sentenced to an additional 25 years to life in prison on top of his current sentence. To this day, from prison, Andre maintains that he's absolutely innocent of all the crimes. He's going to be technically eligible for parole in 2037, but at that point, he's going to be 93 years old. So we know how that works. And as for the families of Jennifer, the girl that went missing and her body was found. Holly Ann, the girl who went missing, was never found. Both of the girls' families have publicly stated that they don't think they got closure in their cases, which kind of makes me think that they also don't believe Andre did this. There's not much knowledge about post-case for either one of them. It was just families have not talked since, but they both stated they don't think they ever got closure. No one to this day has been charged or convicted of the disappearances of the 10-year-old Taze Jackson or the 22-year-old Hank Gaforia. And for those who are listening, if you know anything or anything relevant about either of these cases or any of the ones I've talked about today, you can always contact the New York Police Department. I've got their phone number. It is 646-610-6914, or preferably the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children's at 1-800-843-5678. As for Andre Rand, whether he committed the crimes or not, whether he is the Staten Island Cropsey or the real-life boogeyman, there's a very good chance that he will end up dying in prison before being released in 2037. And that is the case of Andre Rand.
That was a whirlwind. I don't know what to think. I could see making the case for him killing Jennifer. The other ones, I don't think so.
The one for Jennifer, the location of the body and the green bicycle, because that was the first time the green bicycle had ever been brought up.
Well, then also the baby food.
And the baby food. Those are the only things that you could be like, yeah, maybe. But there was also still no fucking evidence.
No. And this was, I mean, right before DNA was being used.
Right. Sure. Maybe Jennifer's, maybe not. We don't know. But the other ones, I'm going to say most likely no. Can't do anything about it. You know, he's got 50 years in prison at least. When he's eligible for parole, he's so freaking old. If he makes it to then, he is still alive right now. But it was a tough case. But I urge you guys, because it is super fascinating, two things. Go watch that Cropsey documentary I talked about from 2009. So that's the first one. Second one, documentary that exposed Willowbrook, because that shit is crazy. And the fact is, I want to say places like Willowbrook don't exist anymore, but they do. That is a horrific system that needs to be exposed in general. Keep those two things in your mind. Think what you want to think about Andre Rand. I could go either way on his story. I'm leaning towards him being more innocent than anything, but I don't know.
I do have a quick little case update before we start. Real short. Ellen Greenberg, you know, the family suing the medical examiner, another medical examiner, and the lead detective. Well, the one medical examiner, Dr. Marlon Osborne, who did the autopsy, ruled it a homicide and then later changed it back to suicide, settled with the family. Didn't explicitly say it was homicide, but said that it should be changed from suicide. So we're making progress. It's a civil suit. So nothing's really changed on the criminal charges side, but I feel like we're
going to... I still don't understand how suicide was listed.
Great mystery.
Yeah, that makes no sense to me. But that's good that there's going to be a change. If you say if someone is dead and you say they've been killed, they didn't just like die from natural causes, and you say it's not a suicide, then your only other two options are accidental or murder.
They can do undetermined.
But in real life, like, you don't have someone that dies and you're like, oh, I have no idea how they died. Like, we know there were stab wounds and shit, you know, like it's, but you don't fall on a knife that many times on the back of your head. You know, like, it's just, if it's not suicide, someone done killed you.
You would think.
I believe in the system and I also don't. It's such, I go back and forth with a lot.
I believe in it, but sometimes you got to check it.
You got to.
I want to introduce a new segment in overtime. Of something I hate each week, because that is my main purpose in life, is to hate. The thing I hate the most this week are people doing the wave at sporting events.
I can see that. I can see that. That needs to, yeah.
Do you guys participate in the wave?
No.
No.
Maybe. I don't know.
I don't really go to sporting events, but I have seen the wave done, and I have done the wave, and I do think it's quite annoying. But then it also makes you feel bad if you're not doing it, you know?
You know what's more of a pet peeve? Whoever started the wave.
Oh, and watching them try to get it started?
Like 12 times before it goes. Yeah.
That's embarrassing.
That's really embarrassing. That's like, I don't want to be with someone that starts the wave.
Oh my gosh. No.
No, that's like worse than like a turkey trot family.
You know what we need to do right now too? We need to give a shout out to one of our listeners. This past week, we got an extremely awesome, sweet, kind, caring, long message from one of our listeners. None of us know her. It is not a family member, a friend of any of ours. She is simply a listener. Her name is Connie. Connie, thank you for listening to us. We really appreciate you. She said some really nice things and motivation to keep us going. And she also said if we ever felt like we were doubting ourselves as a podcast to contact her. So we love you, Connie. We appreciate you, girl. But yeah, so that was a pretty cool thing that happened this week, I will say.
Yeah, dude, we need that sometimes. It gets, you know.
I mean, she wrote a book. She wrote a book.
But the motivation, you know, because we are a small little pod and
we do it for fun. Like we don't get paid.
No, not a dollar.
Not a single dollar. Not and we all live three completely different lives in three different places. And every week we get together, whether or not we fight about the time and date, but we get together, we record the podcast for you people that are listening, and we do it for our fun, y'all's fun. This is also how we see each other and keep up with each other's lives.
Yeah.
And we enjoy it. It can be fucking hard. Don't get me wrong. We all.
Yeah, it can be very time consuming. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but it takes me a long time to write a script. Also, because I like to watch if there's documentaries about what I'm writing about. I like to watch the documentaries. I like to listen to other podcasts about it before I start even like researching like facts about it.
It takes me about a week.
Yeah, it takes me about a week. And then we edit. The editing takes a while. Kylie does the video. She does an amazing job. I try to usually do the audio.
Kate, myself, I do nothing.
But she's,
I had a baby.
She's had as a baby, but she's good at social media and marketing and stuff. So
I'm going to step in. I'm going to step in and do better because it's not me right now. But
she's good at that. So,
and I'm going to learn my 2025 goal. One of the things that I even said this last night to Cameron, when we went on our little Valentine's date, one of my goals for 2025 is I'm going to learn how to Tiki Talk, and I'm going to make us videos for Over My Dead Pod on TikTok. We can post them on Instagram. Yeah. I am not a tech friendly person, but I have learned social media. So Tiki Talk.
She's had a small business. So, and she's a good marketer, I believe. So,
yeah, I just want to say it is funny to just now want to learn how to TikTok in 2025 when it's going away in like a month.
Look, I'm doing my best. Okay. Look, TikTok came out and became really popular when I didn't have time to go on TikTok. And now that I still don't have time to go on TikTok, but need to help advertise the podcast, I'm going to do so. I'm going to help more on social media. I'm going to make videos of myself talking, you know?
Dang, RIP.
Yep. You guys know one thing that I am excited for? This just popped in my head. I can't freaking wait for us to go to CrimeCon.
I was thinking about that yesterday. I'm so excited. Yeah. So if there's anybody listening that's going to be at CrimeCon, or you know anybody going to CrimeCon, let us know.
Oh my God, that would be cool. Yeah. If any of you guys are going, know people who are, want to meet up with us, don't scare the shit out of us. Don't kill us or anything. But we'd love that.
Yeah. I was just going to say, we got to start practicing our autographs. Uh-huh. I wasn't thinking about Cray's fans murdering us.
Yeah.
Oh, and if you ever have been to CrimeCon, let us know what to expect, because none of us have ever been. And I want to know what the vibe is. Like, what do we bring? What do we need to do? All the things, what to expect, you know?
We're going to be so fucking excited. We're going to be like kids in a candy store we're going to show up early. We're going to stay for every single fucking thing possible. Go to all the events. listen to everything, eat everything. I mean, it's also in one of my, personally, one of my favorite places in Denver. So very excited for that too. And with that, thank you for tuning in to another episode of Over My Dead Pod. If you would like even more information about the case, you can check us out at overmydeadpod.com. We also are on all the social medias at Over My Dead Pod. Be sure to like, subscribe, comment, share, you know, get the word out, whatever you want to do. We love hearing from you guys as well. So keep it coming. We love you, podheads, and we will see you next week for another episode. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.